the same as the one our parents described. It may no longer carry the scent of oranges and jasmine, but we will return despite the destruction. We have been killed for 100 years, and we will be killed even more the closer we get to returning. But I am ready for every kind of return, no matter what it looks like. Recently, I was speaking with my friend about the massacres in Gaza. He said to me, "Which of us Palestinians hasn't experienced genocide? The mothers of the martyrs who wear their sons' photos over their hearts, these women too have experienced genocide. The moment their sons were martyred was their moment of annihilation. There is no Palestinian family that has not endured genocide. Even those who were not displaced witnessed their loved ones being displaced and killed, and then they were subjected to psychological, economic, and social persecution. There is no Palestinian who has not lived through a massacre. And to anyone who says the Palestinians sold their land, I challenge them to be put in the same position and then see whether they would choose to die in their home or raise their children in exile. No one should have to choose between death and displacement, but that is the only choice we were given."
There is a steady increase of people arriving to seek protection and asylum in Greece since 22. So I may not recall exactly the numbers, but I think in 23 there was around 48,000 people that arrived, newly registered asylum seekers. 24, I think it's above 60, 62, if I'm not saying something wrong. So the increase is not that enormous. And we are really far from the numbers of 2015 or 2016. I think that's also very clear. But yet, we really see a steady increase year after year since 22. And that's also something that we see on the ground, because although the numbers are not that high, there is this increase, and it is completely overwhelming the system in place.
"43% are men, 99% are women, and 38% are children. The population in the camp is way above the official capacity, which forces people to live in areas that are not accommodated for living. So the population in the camp is way above the official capacity. So people are forced to live in areas that are not suitable for accommodation. So living conditions are really appalling. So we can see people living in the floor with no blankets. There is pest infestation, some toilets and some bathroom being flooded or broken. That is really not suitable for the person, and even more for the more vulnerable one. So this living condition will really contribute to the spread of preventable diseases, especially skin diseases, gastrointestinal illness, and respiratory infection. And as we say, there is really vulnerable people within the camp, including children.
Clashes with the Coast Guard often occur, further increasing the danger of the journey and placing migrants in a difficult position between the hope of reaching safely and the threats from authorities. The journey itself, although seemingly just a maritime trip between two points, represents a continuous challenge for survival and is usually followed by great suffering for the migrants in terms of humanitarian conditions and basic needs.
Wow. The sea is dangerous, but the bigger danger is not in it, but in the coast guards who chase us. Even if the waves are high, we can cross with the skill of the captain, but the problem lies with the Turkish and Greek naval patrols. If we don't stop for them, they deliberately sink the boats. Their goal is to stop migration by any means. That is why people are forced to sail, even in the toughest weather conditions, because the coast guards do not appear during storms. I attempted to cross the sea 8 times and saw death each time. Many children, women, and young people have lost their lives because of the coast guards, who shoot at us, take our belongings, and then send us back into the water, where we wait for the Turkish Navy to rescue us.
The Greek islands are a key crossing point for illegal migrants, especially islands like Lesbos, Chios, and Samos. These islands are located near the Turkish coasts, making them initial stops for many migrants attempting to reach Europe. From there, many try to continue their journey to other countries like Germany, France, and Sweden. Unfortunately, migrants often face risks during these trips, such as drowning due to unsafe boats or being arrested by Greek or European authorities. Additionally, the Greek islands face immense pressure due to the continuing increase in migrant numbers, which impacts their resources and creates social and economic challenges.
I didn't choose Samos Island, but I chose Greece because it is the only passageway to Europe, specifically Germany and Belgium. Our goal was not to stay in Greece, but to transit to our final destination.
The policy of detention on Greek islands has faced severe criticism from humanitarian organizations and the international community. The Greek government and European countries that adopt strict policies regarding asylum and migration have been accused of exacerbating the suffering of refugees and migrants in these centers. Many international organizations call for the improvement of detention conditions by reducing overcrowding, transferring refugees to better centers, providing necessary health care for all detainees, ensuring the protection of human rights, and providing a safe environment for women and children.
We hear stories constantly about how the violence is affecting the well-being and the psychological state of the people, but we also hear a lot how being contained in camps that resemble a prison with this very high level of security, with the barbed wires on the top of the fence, so many security officers everywhere, how it's also in a way re-traumatizing them again. So we address, from a psychological point of view, those sufferings. And one challenge actually is to find the balance between between having a one-off session and a longer psychological support, because people also don't necessarily stay so long in the camp. Sometimes after a few months, they may be going and being transferred to another camp. So the follow-up is also sometimes an issue in the provision of medical care.
European destinations, particularly countries like Italy, Greece, and Malta, are often the goal for migrants across the Mediterranean. In the absence of legal migration opportunities, many young people turn to traffickers to organize illegal migration trips. These trips continue to present major safety challenges, as many migrants risk drowning or being arrested by European authorities. To limit illegal immigration from the Middle East to Europe requires addressing the root causes of conflicts and disputes in the region. One of the biggest of these issues is the Israeli occupation of Palestine, which contributes to the deterioration of the humanitarian situation in Palestine and the region in general. Achieving peace in West Asia will inevitably lead to improvements in the security and economic situation in the region. There will be no justification for migration. Despite the injustice faced by the Palestinian people at the hands of the Israeli occupation, such as arbitrary arrests, home demolitions, and city blockades, they remain firmly rooted in their land. Resilience has become a part of their daily lives. They confront oppression with hope and cling to their narrative despite attempts to erase it. To them, the land is not just a place, it is history and an undeniable right. With every new generation, the spirit of resistance is renewed, and the determination to remain grows stronger, as if declaring to the world, "We are here, and we will remain." The international community has a responsibility to recognize the rights of the Palestinian people, including their right to self-determination and the establishment of an independent Palestinian state. It must exert political and diplomatic pressure to ensure that Israel respects international law. In addition, there is a duty to support legal accountability by backing the efforts of the International Criminal Court in investigating war crimes committed in the Palestinian territories. Providing humanitarian assistance is also essential, particularly for Palestinians in Gaza, the West Bank, and for refugees living abroad.
This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, physical suffering. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to A to Z here on I'm Being English Radio with me, Sister Zainab. And, you know, the topic of physical suffering is, it's a very big and important one. It's something that all of us talk about very much, because obviously we talk about physical suffering in terms of, you know, what is the reason behind physical suffering? Why do we have to go through physical suffering? And what can we gain, in a sense? What wisdom can we gain from physical suffering? How do we deal with it? How do we understand it in terms of our faith, even? But I just want to... So there's a specific thing also about physical suffering and how we ourselves respond to it, or sometimes even don't respond to it visibly. So I'm going to just mention something from the life of one of the martyrs from the whole defence, the name of Saeed Janbozorgi. So he is one of the martyrs who died after the whole defence of basically horrible injuries sustained during the whole defence. And so he was suffering more and more from these war injuries. So basically he was in constant pain, but he still wouldn't complain. So his daughter was still quite young and would cry a lot. But he didn't say a thing. He didn't really complain to his wife, didn't say anything to the children. And even when, so the pain got so strong that the pain was actually visible in his eyes, so to his wife, but he wouldn't say anything. And yeah, so we have to ask ourselves, so what level of, resilience and patience and strength is this? And actually also love, so love for the children in particular. But I'll talk about this a little bit more. Welcome back to A to Z here on I'm Being Trade with me, Sister Zainab, and talking about this attitude that some people do have, which is to, you know, withstand physical suffering to such an extent that they still lead their lives. They don't really let on to other people how much pain they're in, and there might be very good reasons. You may be that at times in our lives there may be reasons, times where we actually need to talk about the pain we're in so that we can actually say, well, look, obviously, there's something serious. I need to go and access a doctor, whatever. And then there are those times where, you know, we maybe keep it quiet because we do not want to be cause undue worry to other people. And this especially concerns, let's say, parents. They don't want to sort of, let their children know how much they're suffering, let their spouses know, or even other family members know how much they're suffering, for example. And then also, because maybe, and they're also doing this, so for example, if we're in great pain, we might also be a bit more prone to being what we would call reactive, which is, so reactive is a bit different to being responsive. Reactive is, you know, you can imagine if we're in pain, we might be more likely to snap, to say angry words, because, you know, maybe it's difficult. If the pain is really high, really big, then, you know, we might get more irritable more easily. But many people, alhamdulillah, and may Allah bless them, are able to sort of still control themselves and just use kind words towards other people. And obviously this is something that the martyr, Saeed Janbozorgi, was able to do. And, you know, this is... And, you know, obviously, that, as I just said, there are times where we really need to be honest about the pain we're in. And to some extent, if people are in great pain and have a really serious disease, you know, we need to tell people so that obviously care can be arranged. But obviously, if we're still able to contribute in our families, in our society, still able to perform in the workplace, and if we're able to somehow access that level of patience and resilience even towards pain, and still in a sense have that goodwill, have that love, have that compassion, and just that smile on our faces for the people around us, so there's a huge blessing if we're able to access that level of, in a sense, resilience. So inshallah, all of us can access that if we're in the position where, you know, we really need to be doing that. And that was it for today, and I look forward to welcoming you to another episode of A to Z here on I'm Being Radio, and farewell for now. Thank you very much for listening to this episode of A to Z. And for more information, please also visit our website at www.iranradio.ir.
You'll make out of my breath, but never my faith, no, never my faith, it's my voice. You may chain both my hands, but never my soul, no, never my soul, it's my voice. You may cut off my breath, but never my faith, no, never my faith, it's my voice. You may chain both my hands, but never my soul, no, never my soul, it's my voice. My voice. You may chain both my hands, but never my soul, no, never my soul, it's my voice.
This is Iran Radio, and I invite you to listen to some interesting facts about Islam. Islam does not have an ordained clergy or representatives of a church hierarchy in the way that Christianity does. However, every mosque has an imam, or the one who stands in front to prayer and deliver the sermon. Jesus is an important figure in the Holy Quran. Like Christians, Muslims believe in the virginal conception of Jesus by God's Spirit. However, Muslims do not believe Jesus is the Son of God. For Muslims, the concept of the Holy Trinity represents a form of polytheism. And the continuation of our schedule on Iran Radio. I'm so glad you've joined us. Ahead lies a schedule full of compelling discussions, stirring stories and perspectives that challenge and uplift. First, we bring you Israel Watch. After this program, we have another segment of radio productions. Following this, we will shed light with the lantern. For now, please stay tuned for Israel Watch.
Thank you for joining us. Hebrew Media highlighted a number of topics that its commentators focused on, including Iran's decision to suspend the Cairo Agreement with the International Atomic Energy Agency, the ongoing negotiations between Netanyahu's administration and the Golani administration, the Israeli aggressive escalation against Lebanon, and the situation in the occupied West Bank. These issues will be the focus of discussion in this episode with Dr. Mohammad Swaydan, academic and writer in international affairs. Hello and welcome, Dr. Mohammad. Iran's decision to halt the Cairo Agreement concerning cooperation with the International Atomic Energy Agency following the agency's biased measures against Iran was discussed in the Hebrew media, as commentators considered that Iran's position adds complexity to the situation. What's your opinion about the Israeli commentator's comment when he said that Iran's decision to suspend the Cairo agreement for cooperation with the International Atomic Energy Agency will prevent knowing the truth or the true state of enriched uranium?
Well, I think this is one of the reasons I have said before that the 12-day war was a mistake from the Israeli side, because before the 12-day war, the Israelis, the Americans, they had a good pack of information about Iran's nuclear program.
Yes.
And let's add for them, they had also people that work with them inside of Iran that was giving them also additional information. So there were two channels of information, the official channel from the IAEA and the unofficial channel to the people who work with Israel or the US inside of Iran. After the 12-day war, the Iranians caught a lot of people that work with the Israelis, so the unofficial channel almost stopped, and the official channel today also stopped. So the vagueness about the information regarding Iran's energy program is now much more than it was before. And that's one of the main reasons.
How dangerous is that to the Israelis?
That's
lack
of
information.
Yes, that's one of the main things that let the Israelis today feel threatened, because when you treat Iran as one of the most major enemies, or the most major enemy in the region,
mm-hmm.
and you lack the information about it, that's when you feel threatened. Because it's one thing to know what your enemy has, but it's another thing to not know anything about what he has. And that's why I think that's why Israel will be driven towards an escalation with Iran very near or in the near time.
Mm-hmm.
Because it doesn't know what Iran has, and it's afraid that Iran increases its capacity, its capabilities without it knowing.
And they even lack information concerning nuclear facilities, not only enriched uranium.
Everything regarding the nuclear program today is vague.
Okay. Okay, but what are the repercussions of Iran's suspension of Cairo's agreement concerning, of course, the facilities?
I think mainly they are limited. Why? Because already everything the West can do have done, and especially returning back to the sanctions. So when the West returned to the sanctions, when the war already happened, so everything the West can do will have done. I think that one of the main possibilities in the near future is to return towards a certain kind of escalation between Israel and Iran,
mm-hmm.
something similar to the 12-day war, because in my opinion, the 12-day war's goal was mainly to get rid of the power inside of Iran. This wasn't achieved. Today, they want to repeat something similar, and they have an extra reason to do with it. Do it is that they have no information about what Iran is doing inside its borders.
Okay. However, the negotiations between the Netanyahu and the Golan administration, Golan administration, have not yet reached a result regarding the security agreement between the two sides, simply because the Israelis insist on not withdrawing from the points they occupied in southern Syria. And they conditioned withdrawal from some of them and on signing a full normalization and peace agreement between the two parties. Do you think that Netanyahu's insistence on occupying the Syrian land and not withdrawing from them might sabotage the negotiations between Tel Aviv and Damascus?
No, I don't think that, because mainly Ahmad al-Shara is willing to give Netanyahu whatever he wants. So I don't think that it's in the hands of the Syrians. I think it's in the hands of the Israelis, because if you see what have been happening since the collapse of the Assad until now, it's always the Israelis that are not sending clear messages regarding what they want. They are very clear that they don't need negotiations.
Okay,
they
but then
forced.
why we did not have an agreement yet?
Because
why
the Israelis don't want an agreement. The Israelis are forced by the Americans to go and participate in the negotiations now. But these negotiations, but the Israelis don't want to reach an agreement based on these negotiations. So although Ahmad al-Shara have given them everything they want, everything they have asked for have been given by Ahmad al-Shara, but they are still finding reasons to not reach an agreement. The only way for an agreement to be signed between Damascus and Tel Aviv is if Trump pressures Netanyahu towards this agreement, like he did in Gaza. If he didn't do that, then I think that more stagnation will continue. Netanyahu will just buy time and continue occupying inside of Syria and targeting places inside of Syria.
But what does Israel want from Syria?
it doesn't, it wants it to stay in the same way it is now, divided.
Mm-hmm.
Ahmed al-Sharaa not having control, because Netanyahu doesn't want Ahmed al-Sharaa to have control over Syria. He thinks that if I gave him an agreement, he will have more control, and he will send a message to the Syrians that I am the one who brought peace to Syria.
Yeah.
So Netanyahu,
they don't want him empowered.
They don't want him empowered. They want Syria,
but they already
Syria to,
they already occupied the territories that they feel that it's part of Greater Israel. What more do they need inside
it's
Syria?
It's not about only territories. Territory is one of the goals. The main goal is for Syria to stay divided, for Ahmed al-Sharaa to stay weak, for Israel to still have the ability to act inside of Syria whenever it wants.
Mm-hmm.
So Israelis think about, I took all what I want without an agreement. Why force myself towards an agreement? I already occupy. Mm. I already have.
Do you think that Trump will force an agreement?
Not in the current phase, but later on, yes. Because
okay.
Trump believes that an agreement with Syria, an agreement with Lebanon, will lead to an agreement with KSA, Saudi Arabia.
Which
so
is
I
the utmost normalization target.
Exactly.
Okay, now let's listen to some of the commentary on Israeli social media calling for continued occupation of Syria.
Haniel Aviv, it is impossible to guarantee that there are no light weapons or combat means in Syria, so we must be present on the ground and occupy buffer zones and security belts inside Syria. Yoni Ben Menachem, there is no evidence that Syria has opened a new page with Israel, and one cannot speak of a new peaceful Syria while the Druze are being killed. Harif and Makshi, Syria must be divided into four states, Druze, Kurdish, Alawite, and a Golan state. We must do everything we can to ensure Syria remains weak and failed.
Moving to the occupied West Bank, where occupation forces and Zionist settlers continue their attacks against Palestinian villages, raising fears of an explosion of the situation in the West Bank and calls to stop these assaults. Why do you think that settlers are escalating their own attacks on Palestinians in the occupied West Bank at this time specifically?
Well, I think it's very important to understand the following. This guy spoke about that the ministers aren't speaking because of political calculations. It's not about political calculations. It's about the Israeli community moving towards far right. It's about the Israeli community being fascist.
Mm.
So when Smotrich doesn't condemn or speak about what the settlers are doing, it's not because he is thinking about his political goals. It's because what they are doing reflects what he believes. It's because what these settlers are doing reflects what more than 50-60% of
they
the Israeli community is. So they are far right. They believe that they should just go and kill the Palestinians.
So leadership is reflected in the community.
Exactly. And that's why Netanyahu has been able to do whatever he wants in Gaza. That's why today the settlers can do whatever they want in the West
mm-hmm.
Bank. That's why Israel can kill whatever it wants from the Palestinians, because the Israeli community accepts it. And one very good evidence is that even the parents of the Israeli prisoners, when they were with Hamas, when they got their children back, they asked Netanyahu to continue the war. Previously, they were asking him to stop the war because it's leading to killing the Israeli soldiers.
The same families.
The same families that their prisoners returned to them. When they had their prisoners with them, they asked Netanyahu, go and kill more Palestinians. This is the Israeli community. So what's happening in the West Bank is reflecting the community. The silence of Israeli leadership is reflecting this far-right fascist Israeli drive inside of the entity.
Okay, we remain actually in the occupied West Bank, where settlement expansion, annexation projects, and land confiscation continue, issues that drew considerable attention in Hebrew media. What do you think about these claims, especially when they said that the Israelis are the original owners of this land, especially in the West Bank, and they are merely just reclaiming a land that's simply theirs through settlement and annexation projects?
Well, this is part of the narrative they used in 1948 to just come and occupy Palestine. So their own narrative is what this guy said, but I think it's much more than the narrative thing. It's today, I think in Israel you have several communities, the elderly who know that the narrative is fake, who know
mm-hmm.
that the narrative isn't right. But you have the young that have been educated about this narrative. They believe in it. That's why if you see the polls,
yes,
you can find that the people who are young are more towards aggression than the people the elderly ones.
And that's exactly what it reflects what you were highlighting at the beginning of the episode,
exactly,
when you were speaking that they're moving towards the far right.
Exactly, and mainly the young people, because they have been educated this. They don't know the truth because they haven't been told the truth. All their mindset is being built based on the narrative that this is the land of Israel and the Palestinians are occupying parts of it, the West Bank and Gaza. But what does this mean for Israel? I think the same reasons that led for October 7th today are being repeated by the Israeli leadership, meaning that when you neglect what's happening inside of Gaza, when you neglect the high level of oppression inside of Gaza, you got October 7th.
Mm-hmm.
Today, the international community, the Israelis, are neglecting what's happening in the West Bank. And I think at a certain point, if Israel continues in this same way,
okay, but this development of a community that is moving towards the far right, how will this impact the image of Israel on an international level?
It's not
because the same way that you're analyzing, a lot of people are actually observing this also. Would it affect it, or it's okay?
No, it would affect it on three main levels. On the international level, today, if you speak with the Europeans, if you speak with the Americans, if you speak with any country in the world, they are feeling afraid from the Israelis. One small example, during a football match in Aston Villa.
Isolation on the increase?
Yes, one football match in Aston Villa in England, in Britain, the Israelis weren't allowed to attend the football match because they are aggressive people.
Mm.
That's the far right. On the regional level today, the whole region is afraid of Israel because they know it's a fascist entity. And on the in the local level, there you have a divergence between the two political groups, the far right and the middle.
Okay, but there is still, whether in the United States, in America, or even in Europe, there are far right groups supporting Israel to the max.
Of course.
Even after all the genocide and the annexation and the corruption that we spoke about.
Of course, but when we want to analyze, we have to speak about the majorities and percentages. Today, previously didn't have any percentage that was against the far right inside of Israel. Today, inside the U.S., you can hear parts of Trump's administration speaking about Israel negatively. You can find the Democrats, you can find the Europeans, you can find the stance of Spain. We didn't used to see these things before. Today we are seeing.
Yes, and yesterday,
and
yesterday, Mamdani,
yes,
the mayor of New York, he was standing next to Trump while criticizing Israel vividly on all cameras on
and
international TV stations.
We didn't used to see this before.
Mm.
Well, moreover, when Mamdani reached the mayor of New York, this doesn't mean that there is a huge change inside of New York, but this means that.
But we never seen that before.
It means that you can. The people in New York aren't more supportive of Palestine, but it means that they are not more sensitive towards Israel.
Okay.
You can criticize Israel, but still reach power, and that's the major difference that happened.
Yeah. So no more taboos.
No more, exactly. Although Israel was one of the most sensitive topics, if you want
exactly
to reach
isn't
power,
isn't that breaking
you
the
can,
ice?
Exactly, it's breaking the ice. It's
mm-hmm.
it is a shift.
Okay.
Maybe not towards Palestine, but of course against Israel.
Okay. Moving to the Israeli aggressive escalation against Lebanon, which the mayor of the Margaliot settlement near the southern Lebanese border considered absolutely necessary, saying coexistence with a hostile neighbor is almost impossible. From what the mayor of Margaliot said, it seems as if the occupation is getting ready to launch a war against Lebanon. Do you think this impression prevails within the Israeli entity?
Yes. It's not about a war. I think not only inside of Israel, in all the region, it's known today that Israel is moving towards escalation with Lebanon. And everyone is speaking about it between today and January. So in the next 2 months, there is a sense of escalation that's going to occur between Israel and Lebanon. And what's the main reason of that?
Despite the fact that the occupation has not stopped attacking.
An escalation took place.
This week also.
Exactly. But he was speaking one of the most important narratives that we should take into consideration. He said that, well, we have been attacking and Hezbollah is arming and we don't feel safe in the north. Well, the whole Israeli narrative in the war was that it entered the war to return the people, for the people in the north to return and feel safe.
Yes.
Till now, they don't feel safe, number one. Number two, Israel has been attacking Lebanon and saying to its people that I'm attacking Lebanon, I'm attacking Hezbollah to make it weak. And
could suddenly, this be just to justify war?
I think that Israel is going to move towards escalation because it has no information anymore. That's one of the main reasons. Israel has been targeting Hezbollah and telling its people that I'm targeting it to weaken it. Today, it's telling its people that Hezbollah is being stronger. So Israel been doing?
So you do believe that lack of information is what triggering a war?
Yes, because as we spoke about
by
Iran,
the Israelis on
as Lebanon. We spoke about Iran at the beginning of the episode,
yes.
When you feel threatened, when you don't know anything about your enemy, because if I know what the enemy has capabilities, I will prepare myself. I could defend myself. But if I don't know what he has capabilities, that's the main problem. If I don't know his plans, that's the main problem. That's when you have a possibility to act, and when the possibility to act is higher when you feel threatened. I think in Lebanon, the same thing has happened. Since the end
so
of the war.
If they would have had information, they would have been silent.
They have been targeting it.
Okay. Dr. Mohammed Swaydan, academic and writer on international affairs, thank you very much for joining us in this episode.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Tehran's newest metro station, St. Mary, has rapidly become more than a transportation milestone. It stands as a proud emblem of Iran's commitment to religious inclusivity in the capital's vibrant core. Opened in October 2025 beside the historic St. Sarkis Armenian Cathedral, the station's name honors a figure deeply respected in both Christianity and Islam. In doing so, it highlights a shared spiritual heritage and reinforces Iran's long-standing tradition of coexistence among its diverse communities.
Far beyond its practical role, the St. Mary Station carries meaningful cultural symbolism. Its very presence signals recognition, respect, and a sense of belonging for Iran's religious minorities, an everyday reminder to passengers that multicultural harmony is woven into the country's identity. It also offers a counterpoint to common Western narratives that overlook Iran's efforts to support and acknowledge its minority population.
The station's construction began in 2015 and demanded significant technical ingenuity to navigate the tightly packed urban landscape of central Tehran. Today, the station extends 34 meters below ground and encompasses roughly 11,000 square meters of built space. Engineers excavated more than 100,000 cubic meters of soil to bring the project to life. To know more about the metro station, we sat down with Mr. Abdul Mutahar Mohammad Khani, the spokesperson for Tehran Municipality, who walked us through its backstory.
St. Mary Metro Station is the 161st station in the Tehran Metro network across its seven lines. We have a long-standing tradition in Tehran of naming metro stations after the main streets they sit on, so that wayfinding is easier for citizens. In the case of St. Mary Station, we made an exception. The station is located next to Ostad Nejato Lohi Street, and in the original plans, it had been approved under that name. But about 2 years ago, the city administration made a different and creative decision. to name this station after St. Mary, because it sits directly across from St. Sarkis Cathedral. So we reached out to our Armenian and Assyrian fellow citizens and consulted with them on this choice.
Designed to be both functional and visually striking, the station features about 6,000 square meters of stone cladding, enhancing durability while giving the interior a sense of timeless elegance. One entrance is already equipped with 12 escalators to manage heavy commuter flow, and a second entrance is underway to further improve accessibility.
From the very beginning, in designing the architecture of the St. Mary metro station, we tried, through the use of sculptural forms, paintings and artworks that you've probably seen yourself, to do this in consultation with our Armenian and Assyrian fellow citizens. So these visuals and the overall design were created based on their input. The different elements you see in the station's architecture, like the arches at the entrance or the specific tile of the interior, are meant to evoke historic churches and create a positive emotional connection for our Armenian and Assyrian compatriots.
St. Mary Station is more than a point on the metro map. It's a thoughtfully crafted space that blends engineering achievement with cultural respect, symbolizing Iran's dedication to unity, heritage, and forward-looking urban development.
Across many centuries and long before modern borders or political systems took shape, the land we now know as Iran was home to a remarkably diverse tapestry of peoples. Jews, Christians, Zoroastrians, those whom the Islamic tradition calls the people of the book, lived among countless other ethnic groups, forming communities that endured through dynasties, empires, and revolutions.
The presence of various ethnic and religious groups is not an exception in Iranian history, but a continuous thread woven into its cultural fabric. In a civilization older than recorded memory itself, coexistence grew not out of legal compulsion, but out of lived reality. Yet, as the modern world has grappled with devastating conflicts, ethnic cleansing, and systematic discrimination, international institutions have increasingly turned their attention to the protection of minority rights. In that global context, Iran's contemporary legal framework offers a portrait that differs from headlines and stereotypes. The country's constitution repeatedly emphasizes a principle at the heart of its political identity: equality of all citizens. We also sat with Dr. Ahmad Kazemi, the head of the Research Center for Minorities' Rights, whose insights added depth to our understanding of Iran's diverse social landscape.
How do you view the social, cultural, and legal conditions of religious minorities in Iran?
Minority rights are a key part of the international human rights system. After the Second World War, they were addressed internationally through various instruments, including the two 1966 covenants on civil and political rights, and on economic, social, and cultural rights, and ultimately the 1992 UN Declaration on the Rights of National or Ethnic, Religious, and Linguistic Minorities. When we look at international norms and rules on the rights of religious minorities and then examine the situation of religious minorities in Iran from this perspective, it seems that the main keywords and expectations of the international minority rights, namely non-discrimination, their effective participation in public life, and the protection of their religious and cultural rights, are present in Iran. This is because in Iran's higher-level legal documents, particularly in the constitution, religious minorities are recognized and specific rights have been envisaged for them.
The text of the constitution speaks in sweeping, inclusive language. Everyone, all, every Iranian, to make clear that core rights apply regardless of religion, language, ethnicity, or race. These principles are not abstract. They are tied to concrete guarantees. Article 14, obligations mandated not only to the government but to all Muslims to treat non-Muslims with fairness, good ethics, and Islamic justice. Article 23, freedom of belief and protection from persecution on account of it. Article 29, the right to social security for every individual. Article 30, free education up to the end of secondary school. Article 31, the promise of suitable housing for every Iranian family. Article 34, unrestricted access to justice, protected citizenship, and safeguards against arrest or forced relocation without due process. Our exploration then led us to a synagogue in downtown Tehran, where Rabbi Yunus Hammami Lalezar spoke about the everyday realities of Jewish life in Iran.
What are some of the measures in Iran's constitution that supports and acknowledges the rights of the Jewish community in Iran, and how do they actually transpire in reality?
حقوق اقلیت ها طبق اصل 13 ام قانون اساسی اقلیت های دینی که به رسمیت شمرده شدن از جمله کلمیان
Under Article 13 of the Constitution, recognized religious minorities, Jews, Christians, and Zoroastrians, enjoy full citizenship rights. In matters of personal status, such as marriage, divorce, inheritance, and similar issues, they act according to their own religious laws. They are free to hold their religious ceremonies. Here in this synagogue, we hold prayers three times a day. Before you arrived, the morning prayer was held. The noon and afternoon prayers will be held about 20 minutes before sunset. We perform the noon prayer, then there is a short ethical talk, and after that we hold the afternoon prayer. Our daily prayers are held every single day. On Saturday, which is our holy day, we have our own religious ceremonies. In Tehran, we have our own schools, which operate within the national education framework. But during religious class hours, we teach our own religious subjects. We have our own nursing home, run under the management of the Tehran Jewish community. We have our own restaurants that follow our dietary laws, and our own butcheries where animals are slaughtered in accordance with our rules of kashrut.
Taken together, these commitments form a broad shield of rights. Freedom of belief, the security of life and property, equal access to education and work, social protections, judicial fairness, and the right to participate in public life.
We have a lot more to cover today, but first let's take a moment to catch up on the latest headlines.
Hello everyone, welcome to the news section of this program. Here we'll go over some important news headlines. Hasneem, Iran urges decisive action to protect civilians in Sudan's Al-Fashir. Iran voiced deep alarm over the rapidly deteriorating humanitarian situation in and around Al-Fashir, calling on the UN Human Rights Council to confront foreign interference, halt arms transfers fueling the conflict, and uphold Sudan's territorial integrity. Addressing the 38th special session of the Human Rights Council held in Switzerland on November 14th, Iran's ambassador to Geneva-based UN offices, Ali Bahraini, warned that the crisis in Al-Fashir has reached devastating levels marked by famine, displacement, and widespread civilian suffering. He also criticized the international community for its silence and inaction, arguing that double standards and continued arms flows have exacerbated the conflict. Tehran Times. Iran minister says UNESCO recognition of Cyrus Charter reflects deep cultural roots of justice. Iran's Minister of Cultural Heritage, Tourism and Handicrafts said the United Nations Educational, Scientific and Cultural Organization's recognition of Cyrus the Great's Charter demonstrates that justice has long been embedded in Iranian culture. Reza Salehi Amiri made the remarks on Saturday at an international Iranology conference held at the Islamic Culture and Communication Organization. The event focused on cultural dialogues, opportunities, and cooperation capacities, and was attended by scholars and university professors from Armenia, Greece, Uzbekistan, Kazakhstan, Russia, Georgia,
China, India, Pakistan, Sri Lanka, Malaysia, Tunisia, Oman, Iraq, and other countries. Salehi Amiri said that Iran represents deep layers of history, culture, and civilization, adding that the country's cultural identity has developed through continuity rather than rupture. He said this historical continuity has contributed to Iran's survival despite multiple invasions over the centuries. Jurist. Iran releases annual human rights report on US and UK. The Iranian Ministry for Foreign Affairs released its annual report on human rights violations committed by the United States and United Kingdom on Sunday, alleging both domestic and international violations. Iran has released these critical assessments since 2012, when the Iranian parliament passed a resolution requiring its Ministry for Foreign Affairs to monitor and report on human rights violations in the US and UK. The 2025 report on the U.S. focused on domestic human rights violations occurring through widespread gun violence and unlawful use by police officers, both of which specifically affect minorities. The report also claimed that the interventionist and militaristic strategies of the U.S. government demonstrate how human rights have been exploited as a tool to secure its geopolitical and economic interests. Iranian authorities argued that the U.S. government's approval of the Israeli Zionist regime in systematically violating the human rights of Palestinians and perpetuating genocide in Gaza illustrates this interventionist tendency. And thank you for joining us in this section. Please do stay tuned for the main narrative.
But the Iranian constitution does more than extend general equality. It also establishes measures to ensure that the recognized religious minorities can preserve their identities and traditions.
These measures begin with religious life itself. Article 13 explicitly grants Jews, Christians, and Zoroastrians the freedom to hold their own ceremonies, a freedom visible in the country's active churches, synagogues, and fire temples. Some even featured on national media during religious occasions. The same article ensures that personal status matters such as marriage, divorce, inheritance, and wills are governed by each community's religious laws, even in state courts. Later, back in the Press TV studio, we welcome Ms. Melina Nazarian, a Christian lawyer based in Tehran. She shed light on the experiences of Christians living under the Islamic Republic and how their situation has evolved in recent years.
Under Article 13 of the Constitution, three religions, Christianity, Judaism, and Zoroastrianism, are recognized as religious minorities. As a result, the personal status of Armenian Christians in Iran, in areas such as marriage, divorce, and inheritance, is applied according to their own religious law. They also have certain freedoms in holding their religious ceremonies. We also have a number of protective principles in the Constitution, such as Article 14, 19, and 23. For example, Article 19 states that all people, regardless of ethnicity, race, or color, enjoy equal rights, and Article 23, which concerns the investigation of people's beliefs, explicitly prohibits any inquisition into beliefs. This is something that is not only provided for in Iran's constitution, but we can also observe it in practice.
Thanks to Article 26 of the Constitution, minority groups are also free to establish their own associations, a right strengthened by the 1982 Political Parties Act, which encourages organizations devoted to cultural, social, and welfare activities. Today, dozens of these associations operate openly across the country.
Armenian minorities really don't face any limitations in Iran in any respect. These constitutional principles are properly upheld. They receive support both from the state and from society at large. They never feel like a minority, nor do they feel restricted or banned from doing anything. And we can genuinely see, in practice, that the Constitution is being fully implemented in this regard.
Representation in national governance is guaranteed as well. Article 64 of the Constitution reserves seats in parliament for minority communities, one each for Zoroastrians and Jews, one shared for Assyrian and Chaldean Christians,
and two for Armenian Christians, one in the north and one in the south. This system intentionally grants minorities a greater share of parliamentary voice than their population size alone would provide. Rabbi Hamami Lalezar emphasized that the Jewish community faces no discrimination in Iran. If anything, he remarked, they experience what